Thanks for listening to WPSU. The following Take Note interview talks about sex work and might not be suitable for children to hear.
Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Kirsten Tekovec. Today we are talking with Jessie Sage, a sex worker who writes and speaks publicly on issues related to sex work, feminism, and social justice. And James Tyson, a stand-up comedian in New York who uses humor to fight stigma related to his LGBTQ identity and his life with HIV. Sage and Tyson recently spoke at an event at Penn State called Facts Not Fear, A Night to Fight Stigma. Jessie Sage and James Tyson, welcome to Take Note. Before we begin our discussion on fighting stigma and activism, Jessie, you used to be in academia. How did you get into sex work, and what does that entail?
I still have a foot in academia, I started there, and I was actually studying feminist philosophy. I was working on a PhD in feminist philosophy, and one of the things that I noticed throughout studying feminist philosophy is that feminist philosophers have spent a lot of time talking about the sex industry and the problems with the sex industry, but none of them really were talking to the people who were working in the sex industry about how they felt about those experiences. And I ended up in a relationship with somebody who was working as a cam model and also an academic who was working on doing a dissertation on cam models. And so he was interviewing a lot of cam models. And what happened is that I suddenly went from academia and feminist philosophy to a world of people who are working in sex work, and realized that the stories that were being told by academics about sex work were very different than the stories that sex workers were telling about their own experiences. And so I became interested in sex work in a way that's, I think, fairly different than how a lot of other people became interested in it. I was in my late 30s and I was like, I actually want to know what's going on for myself. And I didn't enter into sex work as an experiment. I also entered into it like with a lot of other issues. I was going through a divorce and I needed money. And so I started camming, and then eventually moved into phone sex and clip production and a lot of other, most people who are doing sex work do a variety of different sorts of sex work. So I've done, you know, nude modeling and a bunch of other things. And so I entered into that world. But what I also realized is that with my background in philosophy, I could also, I took the work that I was doing and started doing a lot of like activism work as well. So what I realized too is that it's not just the work, that there's huge communities of sex workers that are doing a lot of really, really important work. And that wasn't being recognized in academia. So I kind of got into sex work in a roundabout way, but that's now my primary profession.
So I understand that there is some tension between your line of work and second wave feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what that tension is and your response to it?
Yes, most second wave feminism, for the most part, was very anti-sex work. And there's a lot of reasons that they're anti-sex work. But one of the main ones is that they believe that under patriarchy, women don't have a choice to enter into sex work, that they can't possibly be making, like, these choices can't possibly be coming out of free will. They're somehow being coerced. And I think that it's actually more complicated than that, because we could talk about what it means to make any sort of choice, like under capitalism. I mean, sex work is work, and everybody makes choices about how to survive under capitalism. So, but I don't think that there's anything about sex work in particular that's different than other forms of labor. So that's kind of the tension, is would women choose to do this if they weren't living under patriarchy? A lot of them have argued that sex work would go away if patriarchy was dismantled. That seems ridiculous to me, because there's always going to be a demand for sexual labor. And so that's like one of the main tensions, but also that women who are somehow participating in their own exploitation. I mean, that's another thing, is that women who are in the sex industries are participating in their own exploitation, and that's problematic for any myriad ways.
James, how did you get into the comedy world?
My father didn't love me enough. I went to NYU for acting, and I've always been good at like sketch comedy and those sorts of things. And then in 2009, I actually started stand up, and I did it sort of sporadically and drunkenly for about 3 years. And then about 2 years ago, sober, I went back to it. And with, like, writing planned and not just, like, having two drinks and, like, trying to charm my way into a microphone. And I just stuck with it. It's been the most, like, positive upward mobility I have found in any creative field.
Can you describe your brand of comedy?
I usually say that I use my boyish charms and good looks to challenge the patriarchy wherever I can. mostly I stick to that. I do talk a lot about identity just as like a queer, gender non-binary stuff, so that even when I often am doing like observational humor, it's from that lens.
In your comedy routines, you often incorporate dialogue about being diagnosed and living with HIV. Can you discuss your journey leading up to the decision to speak openly about HIV?
Yeah, I live openly about pretty much everything. I'm just a very extroverted person who likes attention. So I noticed after I had been positive for like a year and a half that I was talking about everything because I'm open except for that. And that included social media. At that point, I think I hadn't been really open with parts of my family. And I definitely hadn't talked about it in stand-up at all. And then when you're a stand-up comic, there's always this sort of like ego rush when you realize like, wait, no one's told a joke about that before. And so then, of course, all the important stuff about stigma. So I went into it kind of from that angle of knowing, really resenting that I had kind of kept this in the closet, especially because it was so not – there was no reason to keep it in the closet. Like I had access to healthcare. I was undetectable. I am undetectable. No health complications whatsoever. There was nothing sort of – keeping me from talking about it except for like what are people gonna think. Mm-hmm. And that bugged me.
So you describe yourself as gender non-binary. Can you tell the audience what that means for you?
Yeah, it's not a new thing. It's kind of like NBC primetime TV in the 90s. If you haven't seen it, it's new to you, but that's not new for everybody. So it's actually an identity that's been around for a while, like beginning of time. it's the idea that biological anatomy and gender identity are separate. So that for me, I am not a binary trans person who has dysmorphia around my anatomy or anything like that. There's all these markers in our society for, you know, men and women to kind of keep things separate. Clothing is really one of the biggest, I think, aspects of, like, gender presentation. But also just ways of talking, ways of communicating. There's all things in our society are very gendered. In my stand-up, I go for the deodorant aisle. If you really want to look for, like, the most obvious, like, oh, wow, we've really separated this in a strange way. The way y'all are separating this, it doesn't work for me. It doesn't, like, I'm often I'll wear, you know, women's clothing, dresses and stuff. And I do that because it's more comfortable for me to do that, which I think says something about my gender identity. It's really every person who's ever been like, you're not a real man. I basically am just like, I agree. Like, you're right. I'm not. I'm something else. And that's really all it is.
Okay. Jesse, mm-hmm. In what ways does your professional life affect your personal life?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think I have a kind of unique situation because I do a lot of my work like with my romantic partner. So I'm married and we actually have a very like kind of public sex life because we do porn together and we have fans that are like fans of both of ours. And so there's actually like a fair amount of overlap because we work together. We also like work on activism together. We run a podcast together. And so When I first started the work that I was doing, I cammed under a totally different name, and I tried to separate out all of the things about my life, which is actually interesting. I was thinking of the parallels that you were talking about. And it didn't work for me. I couldn't do it. Like, I couldn't have like a fake life and then my real life and have those totally separate and then also give to my work in a way that was authentic that people could connect with. Like, I was having a hard time connecting with my clients. And part of the reason I was having a hard time connecting with my clients is because I was trying to do so from a totally different person or different persona. So I just started using my own name and being very open about my life. And when I did that, everything got better. Like, my work was better. The way that I interacted with it was better. I enjoyed it more. It was like it came more out of my own experiences. And so I do have, obviously, my own life and a partner that I'm like romantically involved with. But that's very much integrated into my work as well. In ways that I think are maybe unusual. But, you know, I have clients who ask me, like, for him to join us sometimes or for him to be part of the fantasies. And then I have people who are very much not into that, but who still recognize me as, like, a whole person that's living my life. But, yeah, it's been a journey of, like, integrating my personal life and my work life and figuring out how to make that work.
James, how does your professional life affect your personal life?
Well, I don't know if it does. The hustle of it is so... I don't really have a big separation between the two, I feel like, especially with stand-up where it's really not... I mean, I do have a removal in the sense of, like, I'm conscious that I'm saying things that are written and that it's a version of me that's not mm-hmm. always 100% fully me on stage, but... It's still me. It's still not a character. It's still like my partner sees all of my stuff. They're in some of my jokes, like, and there's not really a big separation for me. If anything, my partner recently was like, I came out as like kind of thinking that I might be polysexual because I found myself genuinely attracted to a couple of women in the past year. And I was very like, I think that says something about my identity. I didn't know. And I said that in a stand-up set before talking to them about it. And they were like, could you if you're coming out about something, talk to me first. Like, so that kind of stuff, I guess. But other than that, I can't really think of, they're not very separate.
Jesse, in an article you wrote, the social cost of doing sex work can be really high. How do people usually respond when you tell them you are a sex worker, and how do you deal with the stigma associated with your line of work?
Honestly, that's the hardest thing about, like, the work that I do. And it's the hardest thing because the weight of stigma becomes really heavy sometimes. Like, there are times when it becomes really heavy. I am lucky because I'm privileged in a lot of ways. I can be out. I also teach, and my department knows that I'm a sex worker, but I teach gender and sexuality, so that was, like, part of the reason that they wanted me to be there. So there was a long period of time that I wasn't open about the work that I did. That living a double life became so difficult for me that I couldn't do it anymore. And I had to make a decision about whether I was going to just be open about the work I do or not. And I remember that there was, when I first got into the work, I remember talking to somebody and she said that she doesn't think that you can be halfway in. You have to either decide to do it or not do it. And when I first started, I was like, no, I should be able to kind of experiment with this and do it. And I don't think that that's, I think she's right. I don't think that that's true. Because it kind of overtakes your whole life. But yeah, there's a really heavy weight to it. And you have to be willing to shoulder that. But also, I mean, that's why we fight against it, because I don't think that it should be like this.
James, you use comedy to fight HIV stigma. Can you discuss what this means, and are there any caveats?
Yeah, it's really easy to fight stigma because I'm healthy, and at this point with HIV, it's to a point where I take one pill a day. There are no side effects. I'm what's called undetectable, which means as long as I have access to healthcare, it will never turn into AIDS. I can't give it to anybody. I can't transmit HIV, which I think most people just don't even know. And so it's really easy to, especially with comedy, make people really tense and then start playing with that because I have processed it and it's fine. Often in comedy with harder subjects, if you, the like comic, have emotionally processed it or physically or whatever it is, it's really easy to then laugh about it. Whereas when it comes to like stuff about, I don't know, my dad or, you know, any kind of material where, like, I'm still working on that with my therapist, it's hard to then laugh about it or get other people to laugh about it. I will say the caveat for me is that I try to be really aware of whether I'm punching up or punching down. So, like, I don't make AIDS jokes, for instance. Like, I never make AIDS as the punchline because AIDS is still a thing. AIDS is not HIV. AIDS is what you get when you are not able to treat your HIV. Like, it's, if someone has AIDS, they are probably in dire straits. And that's not, I don't know how to really navigate that in a way that's funny, even. I just don't know how.
This is Take Note on WPSU. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Jesse Sage, a sex worker who writes and speaks publicly on issues related to sex work, feminism, and social justice. And James Tyson, a stand-up comedian in New York who uses humor to fight stigma related to his LGBTQ identity and his life with HIV. So you talked about punching up and punching down. And as someone in the comedy scene, I want to get your take on Dave Chappelle's comedy special, Sticks and Stones. It upset some people in the LGBTQ community. What do you have to say about it?
What I have to say about it is that there's a big divide in comedy right now over how we get to a laugh. And punching up and punching down is like a big part of this, where if you are going after a community that is overwhelmingly, oppressed and a community that has a 40% suicide attempt rate, then maybe that's not what you should put on your national special that's going to be watched by, you know, millions and millions of people. I mean, particularly with that special, there are moments where Dave Chappelle tells a joke that's very clearly framed out of empathy for trans people. There's a couple jokes that are like about that show glimmers of like understanding for what it is to be trans in America at this moment. At best, Dave Chappelle's special is poorly timed. And in my opinion, if you're going to say something into a microphone about trans people, I'd prefer if you guided people's attention towards the way in which they are systematically being hounded after.
You have something called non-toxic open mics, correct?
Yeah, so in stand-up comedy in New York, the way you get into it is the open mic scene. And there are hundreds of open mics for stand-up where it's not only like how you get better at it, it's how you meet people, it's how you build a community. And in New York, there's not really audience that goes to it. It's comics. You, as a comic, you are the audience. You are also the performer. And those rooms, despite it being the most progressive, one of the most progressive cities in the country, are skewing very straight white male or just straight male. And if you are a woman or LGBTQ plus, it is very hard to get honest feedback about your material. But then even beyond that, on a social level, it's hard to walk into the room as a, you know, quote unquote man in a dress without just flat out being taunted by the other people who are supposed to be my adult colleagues. Like, case in point, there's a mic called the People's Mic, hosted by Jimmy Peoples, whose name I will shout to the heavens as being one of the biggest pieces of garbage in the New York comedy scene. And the second I walked into that mic in a dress, I mean literally the moment I walked in the room, the three comics on stage started kind of making fun of me for being dressed like a woman. The moment I walked in the room, which is something that if you don't look like me or if you look like them, doesn't happen to you. You're able to go to those rooms and work on your material and leave. And it's not even about, like, I get so angry about it because the accusation when you start building, okay, quote-unquote safe spaces or, in this case, open mics that are just primarily the sign-ups or whatever it is are geared towards the sensibilities of women and LGBTQ+. Or there are rules kind of set, like, you know, please do not get on this stage and start delivering your hack jokes about how trans women aren't women or you're, you know, a white person who thinks they figured out some new clever way to say the N-word into a microphone. Don't do that here. And we're telling you not to do that here because the audience is, first of all, your other comics, but also the audience won't like it. Like, we're telling you what the audience won't like. And as a comic, you need to adapt to that. So there are mics in the city that do this and track it, but there's no, at the moment, which is why I started it, there was no website that you could go to as someone working in comedy where you could track those mics so you can safely navigate the scene. And that's why I started on my website this calendar that is just a list. They're not my mics. One of them is, but out of the 20 mics that are on there now, it's you know, they're all ran by other people. It's just I've rounded up all the ones that geared towards women and LGBTQ+.
Jesse, in the state of Pennsylvania, there's been concerns that law officials are going too far in their prostitution stings. In one instance, a woman posted an ad, arranged a time to meet with an officer, then was arrested after performing the sexual acts on the officer. Many wonder why the arrest wasn't made before she began those sexual acts on the officer. Can you provide some insights into this issue?
Yeah, this happens all the time, and it's a really big issue. Officers often have sex with sex workers before they arrest them. They often have sex with them multiple times. They make multiple meetings and have sex with them, and the sex work community is very aware of the fact that this happens and wants to reframe this as rape. I mean, sex under false pretenses is rape. And so in SWAP, in our sex worker outreach project, and a lot of other sex work organizing, we've spent a lot of time talking about this and how and trying to bring attention to judges and lawmakers and saying that there should be prohibitions against this. Officers shouldn't be able to have sex with sex workers and then use that as evidence to arrest them. But this is something that happens often. That's not an isolated case. This is a systemic problem, and it's a systemic problem that traumatizes sex workers.
You also wrote, many forms of sex work are criminalized. Can you explain criminalized sex work and authorized sex work and provide examples?
Yeah, so prostitution is criminalized in most places. And other forms of sex work aren't criminalized. So other forms of sex work are phone sex, stripping, dominatrix work is kind of a gray area. Camming, porn, all of these things aren't criminalized. They are, however, highly stigmatized. So it doesn't matter if they're criminalized or not. There's still a lot of legal repercussions that you can have for being a sex worker, even if the work that you're doing is not criminal. So people still lose custody of their kids, for example, for doing legal work like camming or porn if a judge decides that they shouldn't, like they're unfit to be parents. Sex workers' bank accounts get shut down all the time, and there's no legal recourse for that because sex workers aren't a protected class. So most forms of sex work are not illegal or not criminalized. However, that doesn't really matter in some ways.
So do you think that the forms that are criminalized, do you think that they should be decriminalized?
Yeah, I think they should be decriminalized. Yeah, they're consensual acts between adults. So long as they're consensual acts between adults, I don't see why that those acts should be criminalized.
I've heard you describe how phone sex has given you more insight into human psychology and sexuality than did all your years in studying in academia.
Yeah, that's true.
Can you share some of those insights here?
Phone sex is a wild thing. I mean, I don't know. I think that one of the things that's really, I think this is about a lot about masculinity. So men in our culture aren't allowed to share their feelings about things, and they aren't allowed to talk about their own desires or their own insecurities. And what happens in phone sex is that because it's somewhat anonymous, they know who I am because they choose to call me, but I don't know who they are unless they choose to tell me, and sometimes they do. But the anonymity of it and the privateness of it means that men tell me lots of things that I've never heard before, even from partners, because they're low-stakes relationships, too. Like, oftentimes they'll call to talk to somebody in the same way that I think people do with therapists, to say things that they are afraid to say in the relationships that they're very close with, right? So they care what their partners think about how they're feeling about their own bodies, how what sort of insecurities they have about sex. But they don't really care what I think, which isn't a negative thing. It means it opens up space for them to express things that they don't express in any other avenue of their lives. So one of the things that I think has been the most powerful to me is how damaged men are by patriarchy, which I think is not something that I had an appreciation for or access to prior to doing this work. And because, I mean, from the perspective of a woman, like, for the most part, cis men are benefiting from patriarchy, but they're also being, like, really damaged by it at the same time, in ways that are very different than people who aren't cis men, obviously. But so I feel like, I mean, I obviously get a glimpse into all sorts of kinks that I didn't even know existed before I did this work. So that's kind of interesting. But more than that, more than just now I know acronyms for every single sort of sex act that could ever take place that I didn't know before. Besides that, because that's more trivial, I also have spent a lot of time talking to men about their pain and the things that have hurt them and the things that they're insecure about and how the masks that they feel that they're forced to wear.
Jesse Sage and James Tyson, thank you both for coming in and talking with us. We've been talking with Jesse Sage, a sex worker who writes and speaks publicly on issues related to sex work, feminism, and social justice. And James Tyson, a stand-up comedian in New York who uses humor to fight stigma related to his LGBTQ identity and his life with HIV. To hear this and other episodes of Take Note, visit wpsu.org/take note. For WPSU, I'm Kirsten Tekovec.